Oh, my. All women. This is my first attendance at a women's conference. And I'm not only delighted to have been invited, and I thank the committee for the invitation, but really today I have been thrilled with meeting so many women. It's nice. Thank you. I've met a lot of old friends, and I'm hoping that after this evening you'll come up and we'll be new friends. My name is Harriet. I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Coral Gables group. I live in the city of Miami, to the south of us. And I'm mighty glad to be here. I'm looking around at all these, hey, doll. There's a whole busload here from Fort Myers, and if anything should happen right now, they could tell you my story. And Monica could, too, from O'Galley. I'm a Pennsylvania girl by birth. I was born in... Hooray for Pennsylvania! Northeastern Pennsylvania. Wilkesboro, Kingston, Scranton, Dallas, Harvey's Lake. I was born in Kingston, Pennsylvania, which is across the Susquehanna River, and I'm an only child. I don't think we have any statistics on only children, but I hear an awful lot of us say that we are. And if we're not an only child, many times we're the favored child or the special child in a family. And my self-centeredness and selfishness started right there. I was loved. I was wanted. My parents gave me a wonderful bringing up. They weren't rich, but they were certainly far from poor. My father was a self-made businessman. And my mother was well-educated and wanted me to have a good education. My father didn't finish grade school, and he wanted me to have a good education. So with what there was to work with, I had a good education and a good social background. My father was a good businessman. And I can remember as a young girl, a little girl, my father saying, I've been asked to sponsor so-and-so into this particular club, and I'm not sure I want to. He's not a principled man. He's not very honest. I don't like to do business with him. And on the other hand, you might say, well, I've been asked to sponsor this fellow, and he's so great, and he's a good, honest man, and I like to do business with him, and I would be glad to sponsor him. And I remember my mother saying similar things about the lady. She was active in various women's activities. And so I knew early on that sponsorship dealt with personalities, with their reliability, with their honesty, and with their bank accounts. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I began to hear about sponsorship, and I didn't hear it for a long time, I didn't hear anything about sponsorship, but when I did, I thought you were going to investigate me, like my father and my mother did with the people they sponsored. And you were going to look into my background and my morals and my bank account. And so I didn't speak up at all because I was afraid you wouldn't let me in. But I knew what principles were. And when I began to understand the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles, I began to grow because I knew basically what they were. And all I had to do was to practice these principles in all my affairs on a daily basis, and I felt that I could get better. My parents sent me away to school when I was young, and I began to study to be a school teacher. And we had lived in the country in a very big house, and it was an old farmhouse done over, and it had a lot of doors. One door was for the preacher because it was the closest to the church, and that was the door he always came to. And there was a door for the milkman, and there was a door for the grocery boy, and there was a door for the upstairs for the guests who drove in. And then there was the door, it was the bootlegger's door. And in bootleg times, that doorbell would ring, and you'd go there, and there might not be anybody there, but there would be a brown paper bag. And sometimes I would be the one to bring it in. And I knew what was in it. It was a pretty brown bottle. And when you took the cork off, it smelled good. And on the outside it said Rittenhouse. Those of you from Philadelphia know Rittenhouse. And that was put into the bathroom. It was medicine. And when anybody wanted to drink a highball, you had to go to the bathroom to pick up the medicine bottle of Rittenhouse and bring it downstairs and make a highball. And then it went back to the bathroom. And if I got to do that, I smelled it all the way. And once in a while, I drank something out of somebody's glass that was left over. And I just knew, and I remember the man's name. His name was Andy Bittenbender. Now, I don't think that's a name a little kid remembers very often. But you see, it was important to me. And my first drink, when my folks were playing bridge, and along about 11 o'clock at night, they'd say, "Oh, that's enough. Let's go down to Ray Hoddle's for some clams." And at 11 o'clock at night, they'd go down to Ray's and order clams and some brown stuff in a bottle, in a pitcher. And they'd pour me a little glass, even smaller than this. And they'd say, "Drink this. It'll help your indigestion." And I didn't know that I had indigestion. But I drank it, and it was bitter, and it tasted funny, and it left a little white thing around my lips. And I said, "Wasn't that good?" It made me feel part of the crowd. I was grown up, and it was important to me. I have heard that those of us who remember our first drink or first drinks probably are alcoholic because it was important. The social drinker doesn't really pay much attention to his or her first drink. I remember my first drinks very well. The next time I remember drinking was when I was about 15. I was going away to college in the fall. And I got the measles, and the doctor prescribed a little port wine to help me get my strength back. And I want to tell you, drink enough of it, it'll give you strength. My father didn't know what a little port wine was, and he left the bottle right by my bed. And when he came back a few hours later, I had drunk most of it. I had been sick, I vomited, and I passed out and came to and said, "Wasn't it good?" A few short years ago, down my area, they were just getting ready to start an open speaker meeting, and the speaker hadn't shown up. And a gentleman came in, looked so nice, and he was a visitor from another town. And they just met him briefly, and finally they said, "Oh, our speaker hasn't come up. Would you be our speaker for tonight?" And he did. He gave him a walloping story. And when the chips were passed out, he took a white one. So perhaps I'd better tell you my sobriety date before I go any further. I don't want you to think I'm picking up a white, a red, or blue, or whatever. I've had a few. I just was given in January the 14th my 35th sobriety date. Thank you. And if you're sober just a few years less, or you're coming into the program and you say to me, "I have only 3 years, I have just 6 months," just remember that's very important. You don't get 35 years without having 35 months and 35 days and 35 minutes. So if you are at that level now where you have a day, a few days, a few weeks, you're very important. And we welcome you. We need you. They say the old timers may be the backbone, but by golly, you're the lifeblood. And keep coming. And it's so nice to see so many good-looking ladies. You know, it's nice. My drinking, of course, progressed because I had an illness. I didn't know that. It was a progressive illness. And I didn't drink all the way through high school or all the way through college, but I do remember my junior and senior year, probably, we were beginning to get a little bootleg booze, and still prohibition time. And I'll give you another clue here. I took my last drink 35 years ago on my 39th birthday. So now you can figure that out. So we're still talking. I don't know why you're clapping 74 years, you know, that's but if you want to, that's fine. I'm 74 years old. I was in January. When I came to you at 39, I was old. I was old. I was dying. And I wanted to die. And today, don't you tell me I'm going to die. I'm going to live forever. With this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have so much to do, and it's so much fun while we're doing it. So keep on coming to these meetings. During my junior, senior college, I can remember we'd get a pint of booze, and we'd pass it around between four of us, two couples. And that would be at intermission time. And they'd take that top off, and again, as soon as the top came off, I'd get giggly. I always knew what to do. You know, I knew how to react. And it was always on my mind from the first time of that, from that very first drink, it was always on my mind. The mental obsession with me started early on. And when the book tells us that it's a mental obsession, it doesn't mean we sit drooling all the time, you know. But every time booze was mentioned in any form, my ears perked up and I wanted to know where it was. Was there enough for you and enough for me? And if there wasn't enough for you and me, forget you. And so we'd pass this little bottle around and I'd get giddy and silly on one or two drinks or even the smell of it. And what I did not remember until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was the fact that at that dance after intermission, I would be dancing with, say, Tom, and suddenly I would be dancing with Dick or Harry. And I would wonder at the time what happened. Yeah. And I did not know I was already experiencing a blackout, one of the symptoms of alcoholism. And when I graduated and went back up into Pennsylvania and I started running with an older crowd, and they were drinking heavily then, and older. They were so old, they were 25, 26 years old. I was 19 when I graduated college. I had a Bachelor of Arts degree. I was supposed to be a school teacher. But I was running with this older crowd, and they're the ones that would say, Harriet has the hollow leg. Let her drive. And I would drive from Scranton to Wilkes-Barre at midnight on Saturday nights, all of us drunk, but I had the hollow leg, and I could stay fairly sober. And that was another symptom of alcoholism. I didn't know that. But that's one of them. And it took me a couple more years to lose that resistance. And so my father told me we were broke, that there was a depression on. And here I began to think back now, and I see this is where my self-centeredness, the selfishness. 4 years of college, my parents sending me all these nice, pretty clothes to wear to parties and entertaining my beaus, and they'd say, now don't bring him home again, we don't like him. And my mother would send a pretty dress to me, and she'd say, now wear this because you're going with Tim, and we do like him, and bring him home anytime. So my life was being managed by these wonderful people, and I didn't know that there was a depression on. You see, I'm studying to be a school teacher and don't know what was going on in the world. Just having a marvelous time being in a sorority and part of a fun time, just being selfish and self-centered. And my parents seemed to condone it. They wanted me to enjoy life, and I did. And so when we went broke and Daddy said, you'd better get a job that pays, because school teaching didn't pay anything back then. I guess it doesn't now much either. So they sent me to secretarial school. And thank goodness they did. And my first job as a secretary took me to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I got me a new manager. See, my parents, my educators had all been managing my life. They told me exactly what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. And I was sent to dancing school to learn my manners and to dance and to be a nice little lady and wear white gloves and black patent leather shoes and earrings. Oh, I hated earrings. But these were the things I was taught to be a little lady. And so I went to Philadelphia and got a new manager. My new manager told me how to live. My new manager told me what fellows to go out with twice or three times or four times or which ones to dump. My new manager was alcohol. And I dumped the fellows that didn't drink the way I drank. And I dumped the friends that didn't drink the way I drank. And I wore the dresses I chose. And pretty soon I began to miss work on Mondays and Tuesdays. And then we began going over into New Jersey, over into across the river to Camden, because you could drink over there on weekends when the blue laws were in effect in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, blue laws. And it occurred to me that it was a little odd that we were going over to New Jersey so much, and maybe my drinking was getting a little out of hand. And I decided that I would take up a hobby. And my hobby that I chose, I went to the dime store to get a hobby. Where else? I didn't want to waste any money on this. And I bought a painting by the numbers kit. And I set up my art studio in a rented room in a private home. And I had kitchen privileges, but it was too far to the kitchen. I kept my beer on the windowsill. And I was doing my painting by the numbers so I wouldn't drink so much, but I had them lined up. And it was cold in Philadelphia, and my room was right over the front porch. And the front porch had one of those slanty roofs with the drain that goes down to the drain, you know. And my beer was lined up, and the windows were open to keep it cold. And I reached over for one, and I knocked it out of the window, and it rolled down through the ice and snow and down into that rain gutter. And I went out after it, you know. I'm 21 years old, thin, young, athletic, agile. And I went down, and I retrieved it and turned around, carefully not to break the bottle. And I started to claw my way through the ice and the snow to get... And it occurred to me this was not social drinking. And about that time, it was 1941, I was working for the Army, and we were moved to Camp Lee, which is now Fort Lee, in Petersburg, Virginia. And we young ladies who were secretarial and stenographic help were invited to go along, and we were promised that we'd have a good time, and we did, and they did show us a good time. We had parties and dances. And all of our fun was on post at the officers' club most of the time. And I thought nothing of pushing a young man in full dress uniform into the swimming pool. I thought that was fun. In those days, they wore the Sam Brown belts, and they sank beautifully. The Saturday night dances were fun, and then we would gather around on Sunday evenings to just drink and enjoy life. And so when I didn't show up on Mondays, I had no excuse. And it wasn't long before I began to be threatened with demotion. I was secretary to one of the colonels, and they said, "We're going to put you in the stenographic pool. You're just not reliable enough to be secretary to the colonel." And so about that time, Pearl Harbor struck us. And we were at war, December the 7th, 1941. And soon after that, and I went into work on Monday. December the 7th was a Sunday. And on Monday, I went into work as if it were a normal day. And I said, "What are you doing here? I thought you went home for Christmas leave." And I'm laughing and joking. And here again is self-centeredness. I thought, they said, well, they just looked at me like in horror. They had been called back to go to war, to be killed, to go all over the world, World War II, you know. And I'm making a big joke. I thought it was a big movie put on for my benefit. I was an only child, and I read a lot. I saw a lot of movies, and everything was a big movie to me. And here I was in my early 20s, supposedly a grown-up, an adult, and the most immature thinking, and my disease progressing within me, and no maturity coming along at all. And so when they formed the women's services back there, the first one was the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, the WACS. And then pretty soon the Navy and the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard and the ladies were marching off to war, and I wanted to go too. And I didn't want to go, I didn't want to stay where I was. And being patriotic, I looked over the uniforms, you know. I wanted one that would suit me. And I really was getting desperate because my drinking was progressing and being threatened a little bit more with a job. One day my boss said to me, he said, "Do you think today you might be able to type more than one page?" You know, Everything was in the wastebasket. My fingers wouldn't work, you know. We didn't have lovely electric typewriters, and the typewriters were harder to work, and the keys didn't always go where they were supposed to go. Things were bad. And I would look in the wastebasket and see all these crumpled up pieces of paper, and I couldn't blame him. But I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't know I was sick. I didn't know I had an illness called alcoholism. I was having a pretty good time in between these things. And I was well liked. I was fun. But they never could count on me. And I never could count on me. And that was one of my primary problems with alcohol. I never could count on how I was going to react. Some days I would be pretty good. I was still only in my early 20s, and some days I could handle it. And some Saturday nights I was a great date and danced beautifully, and other Saturday nights plop down in the middle of the dance floor, you know. Just never knew what was going to happen. Embarrassing. And humiliating. So I chose to join the Marine Corps. The Marines wore an olive drab uniform with a red ascot tie, and it was snazzy. It really was. And their cap had a red silk cord around it. I was a brunette. Now, you know that was the uniform for me. And I had looked them all over very, very carefully. And so the day came when I knew I wasn't going to be able to make it into work, and I knew it was the day that they were going to pull the plug. And so I headed for Richmond, Virginia. And by the time I got there, I needed a drink very badly. I was shaking inside and probably on the outside, and I had to sign a lot of papers. And I was putting on that act, you know, smiling and pretending that everything was fine. And I couldn't take a drink on the way there because I didn't want them to smell me. And I was, you know, macho, Marine Corps, all that. And I really was very serious about it. So I'm signing papers and saying yes, yes, yes. And I heard him say, "We'll send you to officer candidate school." And I protested. I said, no, I don't want to be a leader. I want to be a follower. And he said, "Oh, you'll make us a fine leader." He didn't know. And so we got all through with the paperwork, and he swore me in. And then he shook my hand, and he said, "Welcome to the United States Navy." And I said, "Sir, I came here to join the Marine Corps." And he said, "Honey, you got off on the wrong floor, and you are in the Navy now." And they sent me to officer candidate school, and they made me an ensign. Later promoted me to lieutenant junior grade, and I'm running around Boston and Hingham, Massachusetts, drunk with stripes on my sleeve, the lieutenant buttons on my jacket, picked up by the shore patrol. But it went all right for a little while. They assigned me to the Supply Corps. And I went to Hingham, Massachusetts, to an ammunition depot. And you want to be glad that Supply Corps officers do not handle the ammunition. I was in charge of some warehouses, and I had 8 seamen assigned to me to do the actual labor work. I had a Jeep, I had a pickup truck, and the loveliest thing, my lovely, lovely toy, I had a... my gosh, I can't even think what you call it. A forklift truck. And after my 2 and 3 and 4 martini lunches, I would drive the forklift. We wore very, very short skirts in World War II, and I would pedal my forklift up and down that warehouse with the forks going up and down. And my 8 seamen would lay there and laugh and have a wonderful time. Until one day, one of them, and I came to remember his, we called him Cece. And Cece said to me, "What's the matter with you? We don't like you anymore. You're mean. You talk like us. Where'd you learn that kind of language? We don't like you anymore." And I did what I was to do for the next few years to many, many people. I pretended I did not hear him. I thought if I pretended I didn't hear him, it would all go away. But what I was realizing was that the feelings that I had inside of me, this degradation, this coarseness, this commonness, this cursing, foul-mouthed woman was turning into a drunk. And what was happening was it was showing on the outside. And I didn't want that. I couldn't face that. And so I pretended I didn't hear him and that it would go away, and yet I knew inside that he knew what he was talking about. And it really happened rather quickly there toward the end. It had been growing and growing and growing on a day-to-day basis. But suddenly I was acting like I was somebody, and I was nothing but a drunken woman. And I wanted to be a lady, and I wanted to be a lady like my mother had taught me to be. And I want to say to you now, I don't believe there's any such thing as a drunk lady. You're either you're a lady or you're a drunk. And I was through with being a lady, and I was a drunk for a long time. I'm still in my early 20s, and I had a long ways to go. I had 19 more years of drinking to go. When World War II came to an end, I got through it. I had all the enablers. You know, the lieutenants would help me out, the commanders. They would cover for me. We covered for each other in many different areas. And I had my parents enabled me. We went to the Marine barracks one night to see a movie. And I sat there quietly watching that movie because I saw myself up there on the screen. It was called The Lost Weekend, Ray Milland. And if you ever get a chance to see it on the Late, Late, Late Show, see it, because it's as good today as it was then. But I saw myself up there with Ray Milland in The Lost Weekend, and yet we came out of that Marine Barracks movies, and all my friends were laughing and joking and said, "Come on, let's go home and have a drink." And they pretended they were drunk, you know. They were pretending and thinking it was funny. And I kind of stepped aside because I knew it wasn't funny. I knew there was something terribly, terribly wrong, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't know I was dying of alcoholism. I went down to the Pentagon building one day after I was out of service, and it was a recruiting sign. I'm a sucker for recruiting signs. And the next thing I knew, I was in Algiers, North Africa. And it was just after World War II, and we moved into a hotel called the Hotel St. George. And General Eisenhower and some of his people had just moved out. And it was our job was graves registration. And the men in our group were to go out into the desert by jeep and by plane to recover bodies of soldiers. And we in the administrative offices were to keep track of them and so on. It was rather a morbid job, but we managed to have a lot of fun because I think all of us were alcoholics. And if we weren't, we were on the borderline. And I proceeded to have a good time. And it was there that I met my Arab. And I see a few heads nodding up and down. I met my Arab over there, and he wasn't just any ordinary fellow. He was he had a title. He was like the mayor of Orlando. And except he was the Kaid of an oasis called Busada. And we rode our camels into the sunset. And again, back to my childhood, the reading of so many books and the movies and all this, as we rode these damn things into the... I really thought that I was going to dwell forever in one of these luxurious tents with oriental rugs on the floor and cushions, you know, and a little boy to fan me, to pull the thing and fan me. And somebody was going to be feeding me grapes. And this really, it was fantasy land at its most beautiful. But my employer, the State Department, frowned on this. And they sent for me and to come back into Algiers. And as we rode, I wish I could remember his name. Wearing a garment called a burnous, and it's like a cape with a hood on it, you know. And I really, it was so glamorous and gorgeous, and I wanted it. And it was fine because he liked my navy raincoat with the zipped in lining. And so we traded there in the Sahara. And when the State Department sent me home, as they did, they sent me home on a very lovely liner. And I wore my burnous as an evening wrap. And you ladies know what we can do with a cape, you know. We swivel around in it and we, you know, and flirt. And of course, I was a little weird. I would get in corners with my cape all the way up here. And I would just peer out at people. I thought I was a spy. It was very weird. It was weird. And in a moment of truth, I looked at that thing one day, and it wasn't made of white silk. It wasn't a gorgeous garment at all. It was made of brown wool. It was full of moth holes. It was gritty, gritty with sand. And it had been wrapped around too many goats and sheep and camels, and it stunk. It really did. I had never been in jail. I should have many times. I went to a lot of hospitals. My first hospitalization was while I was in the Navy. Went up to sick bay a lot of times, and finally they put me in the hospital, and I got well in 3 days. The next time it happened, it took 4 or 5 days. And you and I know that I was suffering from alcoholism, and it took 3 days to dry me out when I was very young. And I got a little older, it took another day. And as my disease progressed, it took longer. My last hospitalization was in 1955. I had resigned at their request from the State Department. They're very nice. They don't say you're fired. They say, would you like to sign this letter of resignation? And I signed it. And I headed for Florida. I had read in an almanac that you could get a easy, quick divorce in Florida. And I had married a merchant marine that I'd met over in Italy, and invite me back another day and I'll tell you about that trip. And so I decided to come to Florida to get that quick, easy, cheap divorce. And on my way, you know, I just never got here. I was drinking, and I ended up in Jacksonville, Florida, and I made some phone calls, and one of them brought AA to my door, literally to my hotel room, and they saw how sick I was, and I have correspondence from that period of my life that tells me that I might have died that night, and almost certainly the next night had not I been hospitalized. So AA came knocking at my door and literally saved my life. I had known about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew it was the nice people. I knew it was not Skid Row bums. I had been receiving a little literature along the way. In fact, that particular summer, I had received this pamphlet, A Letter to a Woman Alcoholic, and I took it out of its envelope, and they never put their return address on anything. They just put it in a plain envelope and send it to you. And so I took this out of its envelope, and I saw that letter to a woman alcoholic addressed to the woman who is still drinking. And as far as I can remember, that's as far as I got, and I just stuck it down in that big old chair that I was sitting in. Never saw that chair again, never saw that particular copy of the pamphlet again, until I came into AA, and I saw it on the rack, and I went over and got it. On the first page, it says, I am writing to you and putting this in a safe place where you will find it and hide it. And my first thought was, well, how did they know? And I was to find that to be true of every piece of AA literature I've ever picked up. How did they know? Because our literature is written by alcoholics, for alcoholics, about our illness, which is alcoholism. This fatal illness called alcoholism. And I was dying from it and didn't know it. And so I had received this piece of literature, and I was here now being taken care of by a few AA people in Jacksonville from the San Marco Club. I love the San Marco Club, those of you from Jacksonville area. Katie, I know you're here. They saw that I got to another hospital, and I was in the locked ward, and I was in somebody's locked ward for 4.5 months in 1955 to January the 9th of 1956. And the last trek took me up to Salisbury, North Carolina, which was a veterans hospital. Nobody else in the world wanted me. My parents had done for me the very best thing they had ever done. They said, let her go. They stopped helping. They stopped enabling. But thank God they never stopped loving me and they never stopped praying for me. But they said, let her go. Nobody wanted me. And when I got to the Veterans Hospital, I thought, well, now I was a lieutenant, junior grade, and surely I'll have a private room. I had visited the Bethesda Naval Hospital one time, and I visited an admiral. He had the penthouse. And I thought, well, surely as a lieutenant, junior grade, I got thrown right into the... I was in Ward D, A, B, C, D. That's as low as you can go. And I'm very grateful for that first week in Ward D because it was the violent ward. It seems there was something about suicide on my record and they thought they'd better check me out. And I had made a few attempts at suicide, but they weren't the real kind. You know, I was looking for attention. I wanted someone to say, don't go yet. We need you. We love you. And there was always someone there to do that. I made sure of it. You know, I wasn't going to commit suicide alone. Besides, I didn't want to hurt myself. I saw women like you and me come out of that room where the electric shock is. I saw them being put into the rubber room in straitjackets. I saw them sitting very quietly playing. Did you ever play bridge with three other dummies? Oh. They'd be sitting there very quietly when they go into convulsions. Some of these women are still there. I've spoken up there in that area, and the director came by when I had spoken. He came up and put his card in my hand. He says, some of your friends are still there. They'll never leave. Now, they weren't all alcoholics. Many of them were nurses who were seriously ill mentally, and they were veterans. But they're women like us, and I know that if I should pick up another drink, I could go back there. The greatest thing that happened to me there, I went to the good ward after that, and I got in. Oh, I was allowed to do OT, you know, occupational therapy. I made the ashtrays. I made the leather belts. I did HT, hydrotherapy. And there have been days in my sobriety that I would love to go back there for the day. I really would. And just lay there in that hot tub and let people wait on me and shut the world out, because that's what happened. They shut the world out, and I was fine. And the greatest fun we had, we were in the Christmas play. And the Christmas play was narrated by the chaplain. And I was King Herod. And if you've ever been in a goofy ward, you know, and you're King Herod. I had a lovely red robe. I had a crown. And all our players had nice costumes. We had a baby Jesus and everything. And the most excitement was Christmas Eve when two of our shepherds escaped. While I was there, I sat quietly a few times and wondered what I was doing there. I wasn't sick physically. And I took kind of an inventory. I think the book calls it a self-appraisal, a solitary self-appraisal. And it was an immoral inventory, the kind so many of us do when we're first coming to the program. But I was doing this in a mental institution, and it was an immoral inventory. And I went back over my life as far as I could remember, and I thought about that Bernice. And I thought, gee, my life was not quite as exciting and glamorous as I thought it was, like that Bernice. I thought it was so beautiful and it was dirty. And my life was like that. It was full of holes and full of grit, and I'd been around so many dirty people and dirty places and dirty things, and I hated it. I don't know whatever happened to that Bernice, but I'd like to tell you right now that I'm wearing it. I've been wearing it for a long time now. It has 12 buttons on it. And I wear it very loosely. I can hardly know it's on tonight. But sometimes when the wind is blowing and life is kind of all against me and nobody's doing what I want them to do, I have to button up a few of those buttons and take an inventory. And if it's very bad, I button all the buttons and I huddle close in my burnoose and my cloak. But most of the time, after 35 years of sobriety, it's very loose on my shoulders. But I know it's there. I know it's there. On January the 9th of 1956, they told me I was going to be discharged, and I got scared. And they told me, like many people had told me before, don't drink like that. And so I left that veterans hospital with that warning, don't drink like that. Well, people had been telling me that, and I never knew what it meant. I only knew one way to drink, and that was alcoholically. I never knew what a social drink was. Not this trip, but a couple of trips ago, I was going up to Greenville, South Carolina. I sat catty-cornered from a lady who ordered a drink. And she sat there, and they brought. She gave them $2, and they brought her that little teensy bottle. And she started to take the top off when her seatmate said something to her, and she stopped. She sat there with that thing in her hand, and I said, take the top off. So finally he stopped talking, and she got back to business. She started taking, it's only a little tiny thing, you know. And she held this thing up like this with the ginger ale or whatever, and honest to God, she measured it. Yeah, drip, drip, drip. And then she held it up to the light. And she only put half of this little teensy thing in here, and she screwed the top back on. If that's social drinking, who wants it? That's a waste of time and booze and everything. So on January the 9th, I went out and I drank like that. I drank the way I know how to drink, but something happened. I don't remember buying the bottle. You see, I was alcoholically thinking. My mind was still drunk after 4.5 months of being dry in somebody's hospital. But my mind hadn't straightened up at all. I hadn't had a drink. And I don't remember buying that bottle. And yet I remember standing in front of the mirror in the ladies' room of some railroad station and taking the top off the bottle. And I saw my face in the mirror shaking, quivering, nervous. I needed that drink. And I took one drink. And I saw myself relax. And I saw myself smile. And I changed. Oh, lovely stuff was back. And yet I realized that something terrible was happening. In my mind's eye, the bottle got bigger and bigger. Remember Alice in Wonderland? And I was getting smaller. And I said, that bottle is bigger than I am. The bottle is bigger. And I must be crazy. I'm 4.5 months in somebody's hospital because I can't handle alcohol. I've got to be crazy to be drinking like this. I'm going to try that AA business. I made a decision right there and then that I was going to turn my will and my life over to the care of those people who'd been sending me pamphlets. Because they were not drinking, they were enjoying life, and I was going to ask them how to do it. And I believe I took the first 3 steps right there. I admitted that my life was unmanageable. My life was a complete shambles. I must be crazy to take a drink. And I made the decision to turn my life over to these unknown people in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'd taken the first drink. The obsession was there. And I had to drink, and I didn't want to. And it says so in the doctor's opinion. Even though the mind says don't drink it, the physical allergy was there, and I had to have it. And I hated it, and I drank that way until Friday night, January the 13th. I got on that train. As some of us were talking about the train travel back then, the trains go this way, you know. The road beds were crooked. You don't fly nice and straight. And the water cooler was, and it wasn't a cooler, it was a tank of water. It was warm, and it had some kind of chemical in it to make it pure. And you'd pull out this little flat cup out of the wall, and this flat cup, and you got a bottle here and a top on the bottle, and you got this terrible smelling stuff, and you're trying to get, oh, and I was crying, and I needed it, and it stunk, and I had to have it. And Saturday morning came, January the 14th, and it was about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd been drinking that way and crying and not wanting to drink. And I knew it was my birthday, and I knew it was 39th birthday, and I'd been born on January the 14th in night. And I knew my life was over. And out of nowhere I said, I don't know if I said it out loud or what I did, but I know I said in my heart, please God, no more. And there never was any more. Today I believe that was a spiritual experience. I believe sincerely that this was allowed me to do, with God's help, what I had been unable to do by myself. I was unable to not ever take another drink. And that, my friends, in my opinion, was my first spiritual experience. And yet I was through with life. I looked terrible. I was very fat, and I had I was wearing arch preserver shoes, these things, these orthopedic shoes. I had a theory. I had taken to wearing those shoes because I fell down a lot. Last weekend, I was with a gentleman who's 91 years old. He's marvelous. He's a past delegate. He was delegate back way back in single-digit stuff, but he's 90-some years old, and he was struggling a little bit in his wheelchair, and I said, what do you want to do, Harry? He said, well, I want to get up, but I'm afraid of falling. I said, I haven't fallen since I was drunk. He says, well, when you get my age, it comes back to you real quick. January 14th. It was my birthday. I called my cousin. She came and got me at the station and baked me a birthday cake. And oh, that was the pukiest birthday cake I ever had. You know, she put all that frilly stuff on it, the skooky stuff, and I was so sick. But I never took another drink. Very quickly, because my time is just about up, if it isn't up already. My sobriety, I must tell you. I have been active in Alcoholics Anonymous since day one. I loved it immediately. I was fortunate in that there were some ladies. Some people think that 35 years ago we didn't have many women in AA. And we did. We had some good ladies there in Miami. A lady named Eve S. I had 3 or 4 years at that time. A lady named Ruth, Ruth R. She was sober 2 or 3 years. There were many men, of course, but there were other women. A lady named Dora Hicks, who's dead now. A lot of wonderful women. And I picked out some people that I liked. And this Eve walked so straight, and she held her head up. And I said, that's a lady. I want to be like her. And unbeknownst to me, somehow the rumor got down that I had been sober for a little while up in Jacksonville. And nobody ever told me the rumor, so I didn't deny it, you know. But we compared notes several years later, and she was looking at me, and she says, look at that lady. I want to be like her. But it took us about 6 years to communicate that to one another. I was admiring her with her 3 years sobriety, and she was admiring what she thought was 3 years sobriety. But this is the way I started out, by talking to the women alcoholics who looked good, who looked pretty, who looked clean. Oh, that was so important to me. I was used to dirty bars and dirty people. And my first AA meeting, and I smelled you. And I smelled you good because you were clean. And I use the term clean the way it's meant to be, soap and water. You know? it just was marvelous. And I came to meetings, and pretty soon they gave me a slip of paper with 16 names on it and phone numbers. I said, "What's this?" And they said, "You're the program chairman." You know? I said, "I am." And they said, "Yes." And I said, "What do I do?" They said, "You call these people up and you arrange to exchange programs." In my day, you didn't say, "Would you like to do this?" Or would you know? They used to do it. And so I did that. I did that for years. I loved it. Still would do it, but you got to do. I believe in rotation. Oh, how I believe in rotation. Then they gave me a little envelope one night. First of all, they said, "Would anybody like to be a member of this group?" Oh, well, nobody'd ask me to be a member of anything, you know. I said, "I'd like to be a member." And they said, "Fine, you're a member." And I was. And it was neat. And then they gave me an envelope, and it kind of rattled, and I opened it up, and I think it was $4.97 or something like that. And I said, "What's this?" They said, "You're the treasurer." You could have handed me $4 million. No, I'd say $4,000 maybe. I counted that money so much I nearly wore it out. But I was a treasurer, and I was entrusted with the group's money. I began to be a trusted servant. Then I became the intergroup representative, and I went to those meetings faithfully for 6 months, and I want to tell you today, I didn't understand one thing that was going on. But I went. And I'd come back to my group, and I'd try to tell them what happened, and they'd say, "Okay, it was all right, you know." And then the first thing they told me was, "You clean up your act." I said, "What does that mean?" They said, "Well, start washing your hair more often. Get yourself a manicure. Get off those crummy clothes and put on get a pretty dress. Let's look like a lady. If you look like a lady and stop talking like a slut, maybe you'll act like a lady and feel like a lady." And that's what happened. I stopped using the language that I knew. And I don't have to use that kind of language, and you don't either, ladies. Act as if, and you'll become. And I look around here today, and I've watched you this afternoon, and I see a nice group of ladies. And so I began to grow up. And they began to tell me about these steps and how to put the principles into my life. And one of the things they said was, I said, "I got to get a job." And they said, "No, not yet." I said, "I have to get my own apartment. I was still staying with my cousin." They said, "No, not yet." I said, "Look at that cute fella." And they said, and his name was Bob. And they said, "No, not yet." But I didn't listen. Bob told me he'd been around the program for 16 years, and he talked real good. Bob never stayed sober. In the 14 years we were married, he had 1 year of sobriety on 2 different occasions. And I watched him die of alcoholism. He got into the pills, of course, but in our day it was Milltown, those non-habit forming pills. But it was Bob Rawls who helped me with my program. If I ever had a formal sponsor, it was my husband. He knew this book, and he knew the program, and he could talk the talk. But he could not apply it to himself because he had the one essential missing, and that was honesty. He couldn't be honest enough with himself. But he helped many, many people, and the most important person to me, it was me. I'm not sure, I don't know what would have happened had I not met and married Bob Rawls, but I know that I owe a great deal of my sobriety to him, even though he couldn't stay sober. It says in a letter that Bill Wilson wrote in 1954, and I have it in front of me here. It's on page 216 of the AA Way of Life, as Bill sees it. And it's called After the Honeymoon. It says, "For most of us, the first years of AA are something like a honeymoon. There's a new and potent reason to stay alive, joyful activity of plenty, And for a time, we are diverted from the main life problems. And I went through all that, and it was wonderful. And then the honeymoon wears off, and we're obliged to take our lumps. And I began to get my lumps when I was about 7 years sober. My first 7 years, the desire to drink had been removed from me. I had no desire to drink. I was going to meetings. I was a big shot in my group. I was the treasurer, $4.97. And going to intergroup meetings that I didn't understand and terrible things, you know. And so who needed those steps, you know? Who needed all that? Everything was fine, hunky-dory. But here's where the testing starts. Maybe the group has pushed us on the sidelines. They take away your little treasury job, and they let somebody else be the intergroup representative because of rotation. And maybe difficulties have intensified at home. And if you're married to a drinking alcoholic, believe me, your difficulties are going to intensify. And then the old behavior patterns appear, and we recognize and deal with them, reveals the extent of our progress. And then in another page, he says we have three choices. We have a rebellious refusal to work upon our glaring defects, and that can be an almost certain ticket to destruction. Or perhaps for a time, and this is where I was, and please don't do as I do. Don't do as I did, because I did this, and it says perhaps for a time we can stay sober with a minimum of self-improvement and settle ourselves into a comfortable but often dangerous mediocrity. And I was there for 7 long years. Dangerous mediocrity. And who amongst us wants to be mediocre, you know? But it took all this to help me to get into the steps. And one time during this period, I said to a lady at a ladies' meeting, I said, Claire, I said, nobody's ever asked me to be a sponsor. She said, you, and this was another one I pretended not to hear. She said, did you ever stop to think you have anything, you don't have anything to give? I was 7 years sober. And I pretended I didn't hear that, but I did. But at the end of these 7 years and the problems that I had at home, I had to go to the book. I had to find out about my husband. I had to read the chapter to wives. I had to read the chapter about the men who cannot stay sober and how all the problems, some of them we have to lock up. And the chapter to wives is marvelous, absolutely marvelous. The Al-Anons, I went to Al-Anon meetings. And they kept telling me to detach with love, detach, detach, detach. I didn't understand that. And I was in New Orleans one time, and I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and a lady named Elsa C. was talking. And she told the same story that I'd heard so many times at Al-Anon, and she was telling my story. She was talking about her alcoholic, and she could have been talking about my alcoholic, how charming and wonderful and what a salesman he was and how marvelous. And she says, but I had to learn to release him like a little bird fluttering in your hand, release. And it changed my world. I learned how to release. And I thought of the little bird fluttering in my hand, and I had to release the little bird, and I had to release my Bob. And my Bob died of alcoholism, and it's a horrible death. It isn't fun. It isn't quick. It's long, and it hurts a lot of people. And I was crying one day in front of my windowsill. I had had a little chicken, and I'd put the wishbone in a cup to dry. And I stood there one day, and I pulled out this wishbone, and for the first time in my life, I had no one to wish with. I was crying. I was lonely. I was sick. I was sober 10, 15 years, 12 years now, or more than that. And I'm crying over this chicken bone. And my phone rang and said, come on, go with us to a quarterly meeting. Well, I had heard something about quarterlies. I knew that people were sober a couple of years, and they went to something called a general service quarterly, and you, if you were a GSR, you had to go or you got whipped, you know. And I said, I don't know. And they said, oh, come on, go. So I went to the quarterly meeting, and I'm sitting in the back of the room. I didn't even want to go to the business. I said, that's where you have that dumb old business meeting on Sunday. And they said, yeah, but we have fun Saturday. We sit around the pool and have a good time. I said, okay, I'll go have fun, but I won't go to the meeting. Well, I went and I had fun, but meeting time came and they went and I'm alone, you know. So I went to the back and I sat way in the back. And I was whispering. I was very rude because I wasn't interested in what was going on up here at the podium. And I was writing a note and I whispered to somebody. And all of a sudden the speaker said something and he pointed up here. And he's talking about AA up there in New York. And he was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous in Italy. And he was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world. And I said, what's he talking about? AA is my group. AA is in Dade County, in Miami. What's he talking about? And I moved way from the back up to the front. And I sat there and thought, because I found out that Alcoholics Anonymous is everywhere. It's all over the world. And it's just not my home group. It's just not 10 or 12 people meeting on Saturday night or Tuesday night. Alcoholics Anonymous is my life today. And I went back to my group and I said, I want to be the General Service Representative. And they said, you can't. I said, why not? They said, we already have one. See how ignorant I was. I didn't even know we had a GSR. And that's when I began to learn about rotation. I had to learn to wait until his term was up, and then I could be it. And I've been in service ever since. And I had the privilege of being the delegate from South Florida at Panel 27. And you don't, most of you don't know what a panel is. That's all right. Get into service and find out. You know, I'm not gonna, all the service people are here. I wish I had my show and tell. You know, my life has become, I retired. I worked for a big company in Miami. And when I turned 65, I said I would retire. And they said, no, we don't have any retirement requirements. And certainly, we want you to stay. And so I stayed another year. And the next year, I thought, well, I'll try it again. And our company was beginning to have some problems because our chairman of the board and the founder was very, very old and very sick. And they said, no, the colonel won't be with us much longer. Stay with us. We need you this time. And I was 67, and I said, I better come on. They said, no, everything's going to be all right. The colonel's still with us. Well, during that coming year, the colonel did die, and the company began to be sold off. And when my 68th birthday came along, it was the time. And the company was changing. We were sold out in one of those big buyout things, and it was time to go. And 2 months later, I was at a meeting, and someone said, how's retirement? And I said quite loudly, I'm bored as hell. And this fellow overheard me, and we have some crazy nicknames for people, and my friend Actor Bob, and he gets his name legitimately from the legitimate theater. He says, come on down to the theater. We need some help. So now I'm in showbiz. I started part-time, temporary, 6 years ago. I'm still there. I love every minute. We have some, it's a good theater. Loretta Swit just did Shirley Valentine. Anthony Newley's coming in. It's not a fly-by-night theater. But there's a lot of the members of the cast who find out that our driver, Terry, goes to the airport to get him. And one of the nicest stories, and was a little lady he picked up, and she was not the star of the show, but she had a very good part. And she later appeared in a movie with Alan Alda. But she got into the car with him, and she says, oh, I'm so glad to see you. But she says, could we stop at a bathroom quick? She says, and so he found a ladies' room and took her. And she says, I drank so much coffee last night. And she kept on about this coffee she'd been drinking. He finally says, are you a friend of Bill W.'s? And she threw her arms around him and started to cry. She had 34 days. She even went to one of my tradition meetings, if you believe that, while she was there. And she got her 90-day chip while she was with us. She's been back to visit us several times. And this is one of the joys of the transients that we have coming through. We never know when we're going to have another member of AA come through. And it's a joy to meet them. It's a joy to be with you. It's a joy of living for all of us. I really like this women's conference. Thank you very much.
Great lady. Neat lady. We have a gift from all of us to Harriet. It has two hearts on it, all of yours. on one side and hers on the other.
Oh, how
thank
nice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
We're having a little show and tell with the gift. Thank you. We're drawing to a close. With a lot more ahead of us, it's just the beginning. And as a close, will you all join for the Lord's Prayer? We all together out there? Okay. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back. It works if you live it.